This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the invasion, the war in Iraq has seen distinct phases. The Sunni insurgency, battles between U.S. forces and the Shiite Mahdi army, bloody sectarian warfare, and the Sunni awakening, which, along with the surge of U.S. forces, helped greatly reduce the level of violence. And now Michael Gordon, the chief military correspondent for the New York Times, reports on a growing struggle for power among Iraq's Shias, including established religious political parties and Shia tribes, which have largely been excluded from power up till now. In his latest article, published yesterday in the New York Times Magazine, Gordon writes that the tug of war among the religious parties and the Shiite tribes has emerged as one of the most significant but also least understood aspects of Iraq's political scene. If you have questions for him about the politics of Iraq, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, the Talk of the Nation opinion page, gender testing Olympic athletes. But first, Shiite power sharing in Iraq. Michael Gordon is here in Studio 3. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation, Michael.
Nice to be here.
And you write that one way to understand this power struggle within Iraq's majority group is between those who were exiles during the rule of Saddam Hussein and those who stayed behind.
Yeah, I think Iraq has moved into a new phase. The war and the political contest for power there has changed irregularly over the last 5 years. And in this new phase, the struggle is more political than military. It's more about who's going to prevail in the provincial elections later this year or early next year than who's going to win with an AK-47. And the dominant group in Iraq these days are the Shia, which is the majority of the citizens of Iraq. But the Shia, there are a variety of political and religious parties and tribes, and they're involved in a contest for powers. And to a large extent, it breaks down along these lines, those who are outside the country during the years that Saddam was the dictator of Iraq and those who were inside.
Those who were outside mostly in Iran?
Mostly, but not entirely in Iran. Nouri al-Maliki, now the prime minister, was in Syria as a representative of the Dawah party in exile. But a lot of the leadership, really, in Baghdad were Shia figures who were in Iran or Syria or London who came back after the American invasion. They're associated with religious parties like the Supreme Council or the Dawah Party, which is a minority party that Maliki belongs to. Those that were in Iraq during this period include a lot of the tribes, and they endured Saddam Hussein, and they basically want a piece of the action now.
And another division you write about is between those who are in power and those who are out.
Right. I mean, those who are in power tend to be the political, the religious parties and who have their representatives in Baghdad, which is Maliki al-Hakim.
He's the Supreme Council.
Supreme Council figure and his son, who is the heir apparent. These are the insiders, the political insiders in the regime in Baghdad. Of course, they have their own contests for power among themselves, and Iraq is always filled with rumors about conspiracies and plots of every kind. Those who have tended to been marginalized are the Shia tribes in the south, and to a certain extent, the Sadras in the south, who have a lot of support among the kind of the working or lower classes of Iraqi society.
Supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr, who also stayed behind. He was a young man at the time, but kind of a wild card in this equation.
Yes, he stayed behind at the time, but now he's in exile. He's in Iran and Qom, supposedly conducting his religious studies. So what you really have is, you know, we've tended to think about Iraq as a struggle between Sunni and Shia, and really what it is these days, it's a struggle between the insiders and the outsiders, those who have power in Baghdad and outsiders who want power. And the outsiders include Shia tribes, and they also include Sunni tribes.
And another difference, you write, again, speaking about the Shias, are the religious parties, which tend to be based in the cities and being very religious, strict observers of Islam, and the more rural, yet more secular tribes.
Right. I mean, I saw this myself in Diwaniya, which is a city in southern Iraq, where you had a governor from the Supreme Council had spent almost 20 years in Iran and refused to shake the hand of a woman, for example. But then you would have tribal leaders, some of whom would drink, were quite comfortable in the company of women, and were more secular oriented.
And essentially what your article is about is an effort to sort of mirror the Sunni awakening, use the tribes as they were used, the Sunni tribes in Anbar province were the engine that helped the U.S. Marines principally defeat al-Qaeda in that part of the country, and to create a Shia awakening, but it was perceived as a political threat to the established parties.
Yeah, basically what the story is, and it's a story that I pretty much stumbled upon in Iraq when I was in Diwaniya, and I met some counterinsurgency specialist who worked for General Petraeus. It investigates the following question. We have a Sunni awakening in Anbar. Why isn't there a Shia awakening in the south? How come we don't have the same sorts of tribes rising up, let's say, against the Mahdi army the way the Sunni tribes rose up against al-Qaeda? How come the American military doesn't have that sort of relationship? And the short answer is, as the article explains, it was attempted by the American military. It actually began to happen, and it was shut down on the orders of the Iraqi Prime Minister, Prime Minister Maliki, because he saw the emergence of Shia tribes in this Shia South as a potential political competition for his governing coalition of parties.
Is there an analogy between al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, that was the enemy of the Sunni awakening, and the militias, the Shiite militias?
Well, there is to a certain extent. I mean, in Diwaniya, the Mahdi army and the so-called special groups that are supported with Iran terrorized that place and really had free reign, and they were a bane on that whole city, which is of about 500,000, for some time, and the American military couldn't control it. We had such few forces in that part of Iraq, and the tribes wanted them out, and they wanted control over the situation. So there is a kind of a rough parallel. And what's sort of interesting is that there has been some dialogue between the Shia tribes in the south and the Sunni tribes in Anbar. Shia sheikhs would go to Anbar for sort of to get the lessons learned, so to speak, of how the Sunni tribes had aligned themselves with the Americans to fight al-Qaeda. What can you get out of the Americans? How can you work with them? But when they tried to apply those lessons in Diwaniya, what they ran into was really the opposition of one of the dominant parties in Iraq, the Supreme Council, which is aligned with Prime Minister Maliki.
Because they thought they saw these the Shia tribes as political rivals.
With provincial elections coming up later this year, absolutely. And it put the American government in an interesting situation because on the one hand, the American military is working to stand up the tribes in Anbar and in other parts of Iraq. I've seen this firsthand. And we certainly have an interest in the political system being as inclusive as possible. So to that extent, there's an incentive to bring in the tribes in the south. On the other hand, the American government wants Maliki to succeed and to be a strong figure and to certainly have command over the security situation through the Iraqi security forces. So the American government was pretty much caught in the middle, but when push came to shove, it sided with Maliki on this one.
We're talking with Michael Gordon, the chief military correspondent of the New York Times, about the politics of Iraq, specifically the politics among Iraq's majority group, the Shias. He says the conflict in Iraq has moved into a largely political phase now, and the tussle for power is amongst these different Shia forces, including the tribes. If you have questions for him, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's get Dale on the line. And Dale's with us from Corralville. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
No, Corralville.
Corralville.
Coral in the sea.
Yep, okay. That's in Iowa, which is not close to the sea.
Right, and I'm a female.
Okay.
I think you've partially answered my question, but now I would like to know if the United States has played recently, because you seem to be saying they haven't been able to in the past, has recently played a role in this reconciliation, and did the surge have anything to do with it, and what plans do we have now that we have an end with Maliki?
Which reconciliation are you talking about, Dale?
The Sunnis and the Shia, the Sunnis being recognized and feeling like they are now getting back in.
Part of the equation. Okay, reconciling the Sunnis to the political system in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Michael Gordon?
The surge was really a necessary condition for the progress that we've seen in Iraq, incomplete though it is, because I've spent a fair amount of time in Iraq, and the situation in 06 was really out of control, and you really were involved in, there was a lot of widespread sectarian killing, and there had to be some way to tamp that down and also protect the population. And so there was a very important security element. And also the American representatives in Baghdad, General Petraeus or Ambassador Crocker, have worked very hard to try to get the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds, can't forget about them, to work more constructively together. And just today, for example, there seems to be agreement on setting a date for provincial elections, which is a very important step in Iraq's evolution. Well, President Bush...
You're saying that we have and we are.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And President Bush was on the phone to Iraqi leaders, prodding them, pushing them, trying to get along to do these provincial elections. That said, there's a lot of outstanding issues. It's not like they've got it all together. But there's certainly been a political track to go along with the security track.
Well, that's what we need, isn't it? So we can get out of there.
Thanks very much for the call, Dale.
I thank you for the answer.
Bye-bye. One of the things you say is, we just have a few seconds before the break, but how these elections are conducted, if they're seen as fair, who participates, who gets to participate, that's going to be critical.
The two most important events in Iraq over the next year and a half are the provincial elections, expected maybe in December or early next year, and then the national parliamentary elections next year. And whether they're conducted fairly, and importantly, whether they're seen by Iraqis as having been conducted fairly, is absolutely critical for any hope to have stability in that country.
We're talking about political infighting in Iraq, much to be preferred over military infighting in Iraq, and what it means for the future of that country. More with Michael Gordon in a moment. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation, or send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Political leaders in Iraq came to a compromise today that could lead the way to provincial elections in the country. A new election law is stuck in a stalemate over Kirkuk, the city in northern Iraq that's the center of the northern part of Iraq's oil fields. This is just the latest in a long-running political drama playing out there. Today we're talking with Michael Gordon of the New York Times about the tug of war for power. Michael Gordon's most recent article is The Last Battle, the Fight Amongst Iraq's Shias, and it ran yesterday in the New York Times magazine. If you have questions about the politics of Iraq, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Paul. Paul with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I just wanted to comment on what we were talking about earlier and why it's more difficult to get a Shia awakening versus a Sunni awakening. I'm an army interrogator, and my experience in Iraq has taught me that a lot of the Shias see the Mahdi army leaders as religious leaders, first of all, and second of all, they also see the Shia militiamen, which they are, as their family, as their friends, as their cousins, as their neighbors, whereas the Sunnis tend to feel like they're forced to cooperate with Al-Qaeda. I've interrogated both Sunnis and Shias, and that's always been my experience. It was always a lot easier to get information out of a Sunni person about Al-Qaeda than it was ever to get out of a Shia person about the Mahdi army.
And the Mahdi army, of course, the militia controlled by, or to some degree, by Muqtada al-Sadr. But Michael Gordon?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of his personal assistants who move in and out of the Mahdi army.
Yeah, let's get an answer from Michael Gordon.
Well, I think there are a number of factors that make it complicated to have a Shia awakening. A big one is there are not a lot of American forces in the South, and it's hard to have an awakening without the American forces that they can ally themselves with. And there's a process of supervising them, paying them, taking biometric information, vetting them, and all that. And we don't have a lot of forces in southern Iraq, and so that's certainly an impediment. But I would point out that there was and sort of is a small-scale Shia awakening in Qadisiyah province And the article goes into this. What happened was they stood up several thousand so-called Sons of Iraq, as they're called these days. They used to be called Concerned Local Citizens before somebody figured out that in Arabic that came out sounding like very worried Iraqis. And so there are a couple thousand of these guys, and they do protect the roads in Qadisiyah province, which is certainly important because Route Tampa, the main artery for U.S. Supplies, comes through there. And they actually were stood up in the city themselves. And what the story explains is this process was actually underway and had begun when the kibosh was put on it in Baghdad. So it's certainly not impossible to have a Shia awakening if you want to encourage it. Also, Prime Minister Maliki reached out to the Tamim tribe when he mounted his Basra operation. And they had a group down there that used to be called Sons of Basra, though I'm not going to pronounce the acronym. And the but that sort of faded out because the government of Iraq didn't sustain it. So I think there are ways in which it's more complicated, but I think experience shows that it's not impossible.
Sure, you're absolutely right. And just one final comment about what you said about the self. It's actually also a fact that most of the weapon smuggling that comes in through Iran comes through the south because, and I've heard this directly from guys who have smuggled weapons in from Iran to Iraq, that the British military takes kind of like a passive approach to the security and does not do security as well, basically, as U.S. Forces.
One thing I've also noted is that the tribes, the sheikhs I talked to in Qadisiyah province, are very anti-Iranian. They don't want the Iranian influence in Iraq, and they're very concerned about the smuggling of Iranian arms and the financial support Iran has provided to militias. So there's that sort of dynamic as well.
Paul, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk with Charles. Charles with us from El Dorado Hills in California.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Neil.
Go ahead, please.
I'm calling about the large cash payments that are being made to the former insurgents to help quell the violence. And a lot of this is being trumpeted as part of the huge success of the surge. But my question is, what's going to happen when these cash payments stop? Are we going to see an increase in violence because the basic bribery has come to an end? And I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, Charles. Thanks very much.
It's a fair question. I would disagree with the way it was phrased. I mean, these guys, and I've seen them in a variety of different locations in Iraq, there are about 103,000 so-called Sons of Iraq now, predominantly Sunni. And they've been very effective in certainly shutting down al-Qaeda, and some of them used to be insurgents themselves. They're subjected to a vetting process. Biometric data is taken. They take retina scans, fingerprints, and whatnot, enter them in an intelligence database. So there is some control over them.
That's to reduce the possibility of there being infiltrators from the militias.
Right, and to weed out the bad actors. And occasionally they find some trying to join these groups or people who have been on the wanted list for killing Americans, for example, for some time. They get about $300 a month. Is like a typical payment to a so-called son of Iraq. It's not an enormous amount of money. In return, they perform a service in terms of security. And the command in Iraq has actually done assessments. They've looked at how much they pay these guys in certain provinces and how much violence has gone down. So if the damage to American Humvees is 50 or 60% less damage than you would ordinarily have because there are fewer roadside bombs, they actually figure that we come out ahead kind of financially, and of course you can't put a price on the American lives that are saved. But the questioner has an excellent point, which is what's going to become with these people? And the theory is that these 103,000, that 20 to 30% of them will be absorbed in the Iraqi security forces before the end of the year, and that the remainder will somehow be given jobs or go through job training programs, and that the Iraqi government itself will take responsibility for this. And this is all to happen by the end of this year. So this is a very critical transition that we need to keep our eye on and make sure that it's executed properly, because if it isn't, it could be a significant problem in the future.
And the model that you describe in this article in Diwania, in the Shia area, that was the same idea, that people there's very little economy. People are out of work. They would be paid for their security role, and indeed they were for a little while. But that was what was ended. Was that American money that was being paid out, or was that Iraqi money that was being paid out?
It was American money funneled through the Poles, basically. But the which is the used to be, well, I guess still is technically the contingent down there, although they're phasing out. The point is, a lot of people in Iraq with rampant unemployment and. There are a number of people get involved in insurgent militia activities purely to make a living. They get paid X amount of money for planting an IED, a little more if they take a videotape of a Humvee being attacked or an MRAP. And so it's possible to wean these people away from those movements and align them with the American-led coalition or the Iraqi government through some sort of financial livelihood. And I don't see what's wrong with that if you have a strategy to integrate them into the Iraqi security forces and to give them real jobs at the end of the line.
Let's talk with Michael. Michael with us from Austin, Texas.
Hi.
Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
All right. The question I have is regarding religious identification, mainly Shiite, versus Iraqi nationalism. If there are some characteristics of this, and if so, what are the implications for regional politics?
I guess the way I'd, if I can rephrase your question, people wonder, well, since Iran is Shia and the dominant group in Iraq is Shia, is this some Shia crescent, or are the Iraqis different from the Iranians? And my sense, as always, is that the Iraqis are Iraqis first. That they have some cultural and religious affinities on the Shia side with the Iranians. They're certainly afraid of the Iranians at this point because Iraq's a weak country and Iran is a stronger country. They resent the Iranian interference to a certain extent in Iraq through arms shipments and aid to militias, but they don't want to confront them too directly. But I think, as a very gross generalization, I think there is a certain sense of nationalism in Iraq, which is why you do not see among Iraqis all that much support for these ideas to break Iraq into different kind of segments of Kurdish, maybe you might see it among the Kurds, but, you know, Shia, Sunni, and Kurds. And I among the Shia themselves, I think that as I said, it just what I observed in the South was a lot of these tribal leaders certainly consider themselves to be nationalists. They fought in, they may have, or their sons fought in the war, you know, or their fathers fought in the war with Iran, which was an 8-year war.
Now, wasn't it fair to say that both countries were surprised? I mean, Iraq invaded Iran in an area called Arabistan, and those are ethnic Arabs largely in that part of the country, and were surprised that they did not rally to the Arab cause as they saw it. And similarly, when the Iranians moved into Iraqi territory, they thought, these are fellow Shias, they will support us, and both sides were surprised. It didn't work.
Yeah, I think that Iran has influence in Iraq. They were party to, I think, some of these recent political understandings in Basra and Sadr City. There's some militias who go there for training. They certainly provide financial support to some political groups in Iraq, including groups that the Americans work with. But I think Iraqis see themselves as having a national identity apart from the Iranians.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. You've also talked about this as a largely political struggle, and clearly that's greatly to be preferred than a military struggle, but it has had military aspects, the move of Maliki's troops, Iraqi troops, into places like Basra and, of course, into Sadr City in Baghdad.
Right. I think I was in Sadr City for 5 weeks and during the sort of fighting phase of that, and I think certainly there were legitimate reasons for Maliki to order troops to Basra. I mean, it was an economic hub for his country. It's where the oil gets exported through there. That's the country's main source of livelihood. The place was out of control. There were all sorts of atrocities going on there, abuses, reports of kind of women being harassed for not wearing full religious garb and worse. So there was a legitimate reason to assert his sovereignty there and in Sadr City. But it also fulfilled a political objective of his, which is it brought Basra, a major city under government control, it brought Sadr City, a major neighborhood in Baghdad, under government control prior to the holding of provincial elections. And I think that Maliki and his governing coalition did not want to go into elections without asserting control over these areas, controlling the services, the patronage, the mechanisms of wielding influence there, because when they go into these elections, they want to get a positive result. So I think there was a legitimate security reason for going in there, but I also think there was a political motivation.
Just to clarify, the oil in the southern or Shia parts of the country is shipped out by sea from Basra and Umm Qasr. In the northern area around Kirkuk, that oil is sent by pipeline through Turkey and then off to the rest of the world. Will, we're talking with Michael Gordon of the New York Times, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Troy. Troy's with us from Fort Lewis.
Hey, Mike. How you doing? It's Troy Leach here.
Hi, Troy.
Hey, Mike, I just wanted to ask you, I'm glad I caught you on the radio here, but hey, listen, as we saw this thing transition now into the political phase here, political struggle, do you think there's any correlations between how we, the U.S., approach Iran, and is that correlated with the stability that we are going to be able to achieve in Iraq, given the heavy Shia and the dominance, what you talked about? So basically, can we reconcile in Iraq if we don't even get on the road reconciling in Iran? I just wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
It's an excellent question to which I don't have a crisp answer. Iran has been a meddlesome and negative presence in Iraq through they provide roadside bombs, the most effective type, known as EFPs. They've provided financial aid to militias. And in recent months, this has abated somewhat, but no one's quite sure exactly why. I think that there's not much of a dialogue going on between the United States and Iran now, and I'm not sure that if there was, our interests and their interests could be fully aligned, given the other outstanding differences over their nuclear program.
And just new ultimatums today that deadlines are passed and there'll be more U.N. sanctions
One new element here, the Iraqi government is talking to Iran. And in recent months, particularly, the Iraqis found a large cache of Iranian arms in Basra. And they sent a delegation to Iran to discuss this. And basically, I'm sure it wasn't very confrontational, but in their own way to try to ask the Iranians to be less of an obtrusive kind of presence in kind of the Iraqi fight.
Well, you also say that, and let me just follow up. Clearly, Iran could be more troublesome if they chose to be in Iraq. At times, the struggles between Israel and Hezbollah and elsewhere in the Middle East are described as a proxy war between Iran and the United States, and clearly, Iran could make more trouble if it wanted to.
I think Iran's strategy is to use the threat that it could stir up trouble through Hezbollah, through its the militias it supports in Iraq, which, as we American intelligence understands it, is some of their leadership is trained by Hezbollah in Iran. To use that threat is a way to deter the United States from taking military action against Iran in the context of their nuclear weapons program. I'm not advocating that kind of military action, but I think the Iranians have out there this sort of understood capability to activate, the Hezbollah, Hamas groups like that that they support, and also to stir up further trouble for us in Iraq, or at least to try.
Hmm. Troy, thanks very much.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Troy, how do you know Mike Gordon?
I bumped into him on the battlefield in Iraq a couple times, and he put one of my pictures in his book, which I'm very proud of. So
it was Troy. Don't be so modest. It was a picture of finding Saddam Hussein's spider hole, was it not, when you were with the 4th ID?
Yeah, roger that, Mike. That was 1st Brigade and everybody else that was a part of that. And I just happened to come along at but anyway, Mike, you take care.
Okay.
Troy, you take care too.
Okay, bye.
Thanks very much for the phone call. And Michael Gordon, thank you very much for your time, as always.
All right, thank you.
Michael Gordon is the chief military correspondent of the New York Times and co-author of Cobra 2. You can find a link to his most recent article published yesterday in the New York Times Magazine called The Last Battle, the Fight Among Iraq's Shiites on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Coming up, do gender tests have any place at the Olympics? The opinion page is next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.